From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coca-Cola is sold in over 185 countries. That's more than the membership of the United Nations. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Mark Pendergrast about how a soft drink became the world's most widely distributed product and a symbol of the Western way of life. His new book is For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Also today, a talk with singer-songwriter Carole King about writing songs that became hits for the Drifters, the Shirelles, and Aretha Franklin. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new spiritual autobiography by Nancy Mayers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin angered Jewish settlers today in the Golan Heights when he again hinted that Israel would be prepared to withdraw, at least partially. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Prime Minister Rabin told his Labor Party colleagues in the Israeli parliament that the public does not like hypothetical situations. But, he said, if real proposals for peace with Syria were offered, the residents there can spin themselves around like propellers with demonstrations, and it will not help them. Representatives of the 12,000 Israelis living on the Golan reacted angrily. A spokesman said that not only the Jews on the Golan will be demonstrating against a withdrawal, but Israelis everywhere. And the wind from all these propellers will blow Rabin out of office, the spokesman said. But peace with Syria still seems far away. Rabin today blamed Syria for the problems in negotiations, saying the Syrians were not willing to clarify what they meant by peace and were insisting on an Israeli withdrawal without anything in return. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Environmental organizations said today that it could be a big loss for their cause if Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt is nominated to the Supreme Court. Babbitt is widely speculated to be at the top of President Clinton's list of candidates to succeed retiring Justice Byron White. Fred Krupp, the president of the Environmental Defense Fund, told reporters today that they're trying to head off such a nomination, telling the White House that they believe Babbitt should stay at Interior. President Clinton said today that he hasn't made a decision on the nomination. In Tampa, Florida, jury selection began this morning in the trial of two white men accused of robbing and setting fire to a black tourist. The racial nature of the attack has drawn national attention to the trial. Bobby O'Brien of member station WUSF reports from Tampa.
Defendants Mark Cohut and Charles Work appeared in court with new haircuts, cleanly shaven faces, and wearing dress shirts and ties, a decidedly different look than the long hair, T-shirts, and jeans worn by the day laborers when they were arrested for the New Year's Day kidnapping and burning of New York brokerage clerk Chris Wilson. Due to the heavy news coverage and the racial tone of the attack, the judge is screening jurors. The trial is expected to take more than 2 weeks. A highlight will be the testimony of a third defendant who turned state's witness for a reduced sentence. Cohut and Rourke, if convicted, could face life in prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street, partly in reaction to speculation that short-term interest rates are on their way up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 13 points to close at 3,532. The NASDAQ was down 7.35 at 694.7. This is NPR. Senate Democratic leaders said today that they expect to pass the president's $500 billion economic package with additional cuts in spending and a modified energy tax. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said passage is likely to be very difficult, but he predicted that the president's allies will have the votes to win. Senate Republican Leader Bob Dole said that the election of Republican Kay Bailey Hutchison to the Senate from Texas is a message that the American people don't want more taxes. In Belgrade, the jailed leader of the major opposition party urged his followers today not to provoke the regime of Slobodan Milosevic by staging street demonstrations. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
The message was delivered in a news conference by Vuk Drašković's brother, who visited the leader of the Serbian Renewal Party in jail. He quoted Vuk as saying people must behave with restraint and in a civilized manner. Draskovich and his wife Danica were arrested early Wednesday after leading a spontaneous demonstration in front of the Yugoslav parliament, which led to violent clashes with police. Witnesses said the couple was severely beaten by police as they were taken into custody. Rodoljub Draskovich said his brother was covered with bruises and scars and that his sight and hearing are impaired. Serbian Renewal Party officials have called for international efforts to get the Draskoviches released. In a letter to Milosevic, the human rights group Helsinki Watch said Serbian police violated international law by excessive use of force against Draskovich and demonstrators. This is Silvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
There were reports of heavy gunfire today in central Mogadishu, with UN helicopter gunships hovering over the Somali capital. There were no immediate details of the latest fighting, but there was an earlier skirmish in which Pakistani troops killed two Somali gunmen. UN officials accused faction leader Mohammed Farah Aidid. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's the most universally recognized word on Earth? The answer is okay. What's the second? Coca-Cola. Coke is the world's most widely distributed product. These facts come from the book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola by Mark Pendergrast. His new book is a history of how Coke went from a patent medicine to one of the most successful products in the history of capitalism. Pendergrast says the book was a kind of roots project for him. Both sides of his family are from Atlanta, where Coke was born. His grandfather owned a drugstore where he served the soft drink to Coke's first tycoon. And family legend has it that his grandmother rejected a marriage proposal from the man who later headed Coca-Cola. Well, let's start with the question everyone always asks. Was there really cocaine in the original formula?
Yes, there was cocaine in the original formula, although the company did not put it in the form of powdered cocaine the way we think of it. Cocaine, as you probably know, is the principal alkaloid of the coca leaf, which has been grown and chewed by the Peruvian Indians for thousands of years. And what John Pemberton, the inventor of Coca-Cola in 1886, did was to use fluid extract of coca leaf. And that meant that it had a relatively small percentage of cocaine in it. I have that in the book. It's about 8.5 milligrams, which is per drink, which is such a small amount that it really wouldn't do much of anything to you. However, if, like many of the people that I found in my research, you drank four or five glasses in a row, you'd get about, 40 milligrams, which is definitely enough for you to feel, especially when it's combined with the much higher proportion of caffeine that it had in the original drink.
Well, what was coca leaf extract doing in Coca-Cola in the first place?
Well, in the mid-1880s, there was a veritable coca mania, as one of the drug journals of the time put it. It's interesting that Sigmund Freud was looking into the wonders of cocaine, in fact, wrote an entire book about it at precisely the same time that John Pemberton was playing around with it. Pemberton had another more personal reason for being interested in coca leaf and cocaine, which was that it was being touted as a sort of a methadone of its time to get people off of morphine addiction, which was extraordinarily common and which Pemberton himself had. He was a morphine addict.
Now, when Coca-Cola was invented in 1886, it was invented not as a refreshing beverage, but as a patent medicine. What was it supposed to be good for?
Well, let me say, it actually was invented also as a refreshing beverage. In fact, the words refreshing and delicious and refreshing were in the very first ad Pemberton made, but it was to serve a dual purpose. It was also a patent medicine. And it was supposed to cure headaches, hangovers, make you think more clearly. It was called a brain tonic and a nerve tonic. It also was supposed to make you more sexually stimulating, make you live longer. It did just about anything, like many of the patent medicines back then were supposed to.
Well, we've talked a little bit about why there was some cocaine in Coca-Cola. The cola in Coca-Cola was originally cola nut.
That's right.
Which was where the caffeine came from?
Yes, that's correct. Cola nuts are chewed by West African natives to this day the same way that coca leaves chewed by the Peruvians in the Andes, and with the very same effect. It gave a quick jolt of energy, and it's also very embedded in their social customs and their religious rites and things like that. it's kind of interesting that both of these products were embedded in their culture and had a religious significance, because I argue that that's precisely what Coca-Cola is to us.
Why did the creator of Coca-Cola feel that there needed to be caffeine in it?
Well, he regarded it as a pick-me-up. You know, Coca-Cola was sold, among other things, as a, quote, intellectual beverage. Yes, that's right, an intellectual beverage. It was aimed at businessmen and students. So if you were all nervous and strung out and you were having a hard time during your day, you'd take a minute and drink a Coca-Cola, and it would brace you up and make you think more clearly. And clearly that's what caffeine was good for.
Does the advertising campaign, The Pause That Refreshes, date back at all to when Coca-Cola was supposed to be a pick-me-up and was supposed to be a tonic medicine?
No. The Pause That Refreshes was invented by a man named Archie Lee in 1929 for the first time, and it really was a product of the Depression more than anything else. The idea was that you took a pause and it would refresh you and pick you up, and it was something kind you could do for yourself during a very difficult time in American life. But it does harken back. In fact, all of their ads continually harken back to the roots that we've just spoken about.
Well, cocaine was still legal when Coca-Cola was first made, but I believe it was like in 1901 or something that it was outlawed?
Actually, cocaine was legal until 1914 with the passage of the Harrison Anti-Narcotic Act. In 1906, it became highly unpopular, however, with the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act, which made you list it if it was an ingredient. And because it was then socially not a good thing to take, it was sort of the death knell for any of these patent medicines that still had cocaine. Coca-Cola had taken out most of the cocaine in 1901, as you mentioned, and they got all of the rest of it in 1903. So Coca-Cola has had no cocaine whatsoever since that date, although they still do use coca leaf in Coca-Cola today. It's just decocainized first.
What's the point of the coca leaf today?
Well, supposedly it adds a bit to the flavor. It's part of the traditional formula, and Coca-Cola is, if nothing else, a very traditional company in many ways.
So was the cocaine taken out in 1901 because it was already becoming unpopular and the manufacturer kind of figured out it would probably become illegal soon?
Yeah, there were a couple of reasons why they took it out. It was interesting. One of them had to do with a government lawsuit. Actually, Coca-Cola was suing the IRS for back taxes. The IRS had said that Coca-Cola was a medicine, which was taxable during the Spanish-American War, whereas soft drinks weren't. Coca-Cola argued that it was a soft drink and, in fact, won the case, remarkably enough, even though they had all this advertising, which was clearly medicinal. But I think that helped them to take the cocaine out. The other reason had to do with racism. Because Coca-Cola began to be bottled in 1899, it kind of democratized the drink. Up until then, it had been primarily, in fact, only a drink served in soda fountains for white, upper-middle-class people. And with blacks drinking it, there were a lot of rumors that black cocaine fiends were raping white women and assaulting their bosses and things like that. And Coca-Cola was under a great deal of pressure as a Southern drink to take the cocaine out for that reason.
When did Coca-Cola go from a patent medicine to a soft drink?
It was a gradual process that began around 1895 when Frank Robinson realized that he could sell a lot more Coca-Cola by appealing to the masses with just a popular soft drink than he could with a medicine to people who weren't feeling well. And it was a gradual process that really solidified, I would say, in 1911 to 1920. In 1911, the government sued Coca-Cola and almost put it out of business. A guy named Harvey Wiley, who's quite an entertaining character, was the primary moving force behind that. And it was after that trial that they really abandoned all of their medicinal claims. And it was Archie Lee, the man that I mentioned, who really took Coca-Cola into its golden age of advertising, who realized that the image of Coca-Cola, the sort of upscale social image or a drink which made everybody's life better, that would promote social good times and things like that, was more important actually than the taste.
Once Coca-Cola became a soft drink and no longer made the patent medicine claims, did they have to do anything to improve the taste once they were trying to market it on the taste?
Mm-hmm. No, they didn't change the taste. They have changed the formula at various times for various reasons, but the taste remained pretty much the same. It's interesting you mention that because Coca-Cola has always had this sort of mysterious patina to it, a little bit of sin mixed in with that. You know, there are still rumors that if you take Coca-Cola with a couple of aspirin, it will get you high, that sort of thing. And it's not an identifiable taste. It's not grape, it's not lemon, it's not orange. It's a little bit difficult to tell what it is. And I discovered during my research that it is an acquired taste. And the company recognizes this, which is one of the reasons they give away free samples. It's only about the third time that you begin to really like it.
How did you figure that out?
Well, because I found all these quotes from people around the world comparing Coca-Cola to the taste of a burnt comb, or the Italian communists after World War II compared it to licking the leg of a recently exercised athlete. It really is an acquired taste. And a lot of the company people who worked in Brazil or in France told me that personally.
You also managed to come up with the original formula for Coca-Cola. How did you manage to get it? This is really one of the big guarded secrets of American culture.
Yes, and let me say that I am virtually positive it is the original formula, but there's no way to prove that unless you can compare it to the formula which is sitting in the company's vault at the Trust Company of Georgia, and they're not about to let me do that. But I came up with it because I was in the Coca-Cola archives one day, and they brought me John Pemberton's original formula book. And as I looked through it, there was one that certainly was not labeled, "This is the Coca-Cola formula." It had a big X on top of it, as a matter of fact. But as I looked through it, I became more and more excited, and I realized that indeed it was a Coca-Cola formula. At first, I thought it was simply a forerunner of the original formula that, you know, he'd been playing around with. But I eventually came up with some validation that it really was the formula. It's a little bit of a long story. I don't know if you want me to go into that sidelight on why I figured out it really was the original formula.
No, that's okay. But I'm still wondering, like, was it a mistake that they showed you this book with the original formula in it?
It's a mystery to me, Terry. I don't know why they showed it to me. I would presume that it was a mistake, yes.
Let's go through what some of the ingredients are. I don't know if you want to give the whole recipe here or just go through some of the key ingredients.
Well, I might as well give the recipe. It's got citrate caffeine. It had extract of vanilla, fluid extract of coca, which was the source of the cocaine. By the way, that citrate caffeine is what came from the cola nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Citric acid, lime juice, a whole lot of sugar, water, caramel to color. And then you had to add in a bit of this flavoring ingredient, the famous 7X formula. And that's made from essential oils of orange, lemon, nutmeg, cinnamon, which is actually Chinese cinnamon called cassia, coriander, and neroli. Now, neroli, oil of neroli comes from a bitter orange blossom, which I believe is grown in Italy. So it would be difficult for people to, and all of that was mixed up with alcohol, and you had to let it stand 24 hours and then drain off the oil part. It really didn't have much alcohol in it by the time it got into Coca-Cola. It would be difficult for anyone to mix this up. Everybody keeps asking me, did I try to mix it up? And I wouldn't really know how to get oil of neroli, and it would be illegal to get fluid extract of coca.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Pendergrast, and he's written a new history of Coca-Cola called For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Mark, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more.
Mm-hmm.
This is Fresh Air. Mark Pendergrass is my guest. We're talking about his new book, For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Coke has managed to spread around the world. And in the history of Coke that you've written, you show that one of the ways they managed to do that was to follow American troops around during World War II. How did they do that?
That is the most amazing story. It's one of my favorite chapters. It's called the $4,000 bottle Coca-Cola goes to war, because at one point during the conflict, they actually auctioned a Coca-Cola bottle off for $4,000. What happened was, right after Pearl Harbor, Robert Woodruff, who was the longtime boss of Coca-Cola, they called him the boss, he made this pronouncement. He said, "We will make sure that our fighting men get Coca-Cola wherever they are for a nickel, regardless of what it cost the company." It was a very patriotic gesture. It was also a brilliant marketing gesture. It resulted in Coca-Cola being exempted from sugar rationing during the war. As a matter of fact, the government declared Coca-Cola to be an essential morale booster for the troops. They put Coca-Cola men in army uniforms, sent them overseas, this is all at government expense, and set up bottling plants behind the lines to supply the troops with Coca-Cola. And indeed, you will find when you read the letters that these soldiers wrote back home that it was an essential morale booster. It really did mean a great deal to them. On the other hand, it also meant that Coca-Cola got this incredible worldwide boost, and that when the GIs came home, they came back with a very decided preference and loyalty for Coca-Cola over Pepsi.
So who footed the bill for bringing Coke to the troops abroad? Was it was the military, or was it Coca-Cola?
Well, Coca-Cola continued to pay its men their salaries. However, the government paid for the transportation of the men and the bottling plants overseas. The government paid for the men to be billeted. The government also provided CBs and other men to help them when they needed repair of their bottling plants. They provided prisoners of war to work in the bottling plants, which, by the way, the Coca-Cola men loved the German POWs and much preferred them over the French civilian workers because they worked so hard. But there was definitely a collusion between the government and Coca-Cola during the war.
So meanwhile, while Coke is boosting the morale of American soldiers, Coke is also being bottled in Hitler's Germany.
That's true. Coca-Cola began in Germany in 1929, but it really took off in 1933 when Max Keitt took over. Now, Keitt was an interesting character. There's a picture of him in the book, and he looks remarkably like Adolf Hitler, who came to power that same year in 1933. And I make the argument that he is similar to Hitler in some ways. He was certainly an autocrat who terrified his employees. But he also had this intense belief, not in Deutschland, but in Coca-Cola über alles, which is the title of that chapter. And he pursued it with a monomaniacal zeal. And in doing so, he certainly did collaborate with the Nazi government as much as he could. Although he ran into trouble. One of his competitors went for a tour of a New York bottling plant, picked up some kosher bottle caps. In other words, Coca-Cola, which was especially designed, you know, for the kosher Jewish market, took them back to Germany, and he had these printed up as postcards and sent around declaring that Coca-Cola was a Jewish American drink. And the Nazi headquarters canceled all their orders, and they had big problems. But eventually they overcame it through all of the old expedients of simply repeating advertising. It's interesting that Hitler actually learned from Western advertisers, including Coca-Cola, and he says that in Mein Kampf. He says, you know, I've learned from these advertisers that you have to repeat a very simple message over and over again.
Another interesting story about Coke around the world is a story that relates to Russia, where there was a Russian who didn't want to be seen drinking Coke because it was so identified with American imperialism and capitalism.
This was General Zhukov, who was the hero of Russia during World War II. He took Berlin. He ended up being in charge of the Russian-occupied zone of Germany, and he became good friends with Eisenhower. And Eisenhower was a real Coca-Cola addict who eventually ended up owning parts of bottling plants, by the way. But Zhukov, having been introduced to this drink, liked it. And he said, gee, I'd like to have some of this for myself, as a private stock, so to speak. But if I'm seen drinking the American imperialist drink out of this funny little bottle, they'll send me to Siberia. So can you please make it so it doesn't look like Coca-Cola? They made special white Coca-Cola for Zhukov, colorless, in other words, sort of the first crystal Pepsi. And they put it in straight-sided bottles rather than the classic hobble skirt bottle. And they bottled it with a cap that had a little red star on top. I was fascinated by this when I learned this from the man who actually made it for him.
Did anybody else drink this, or was this just manufactured for this one general?
It was just for the one general, but it provided them very ready access to the Soviet-occupied zone. They could go back and forth with no problem, whereas everybody else had to go through this incredible bureaucracy.
Coke and Pepsi have been slugging it out around the world, trying to get new markets in new countries, competing, of course, in the United States. What are they fighting for now? What's the territory that they're most competing for?
I would say that the biggest fight is probably in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union right now. You know, Nixon, who was a former Pepsi lawyer, was definitely a Pepsi man, the same way that Eisenhower and Carter were big Coca-Cola men. And Nixon helped to get an exclusive contract for Pepsi in the Soviet Union and in the Eastern Bloc for a long time. That's only recently been broken. And Coca-Cola is pouring millions, in fact, billions of dollars into the area to combat Pepsi. And they are, in fact, rapidly winning that war. You know, here in the United States, Coke and Pepsi are in a real head-to-head conflict that Coca-Cola has clearly, you know, winning. They have about 40% of the market to Pepsi's 30%. But overseas, it's a massacre. Coca-Cola dominates quite thoroughly, about I think it's something like 3-1 overseas. So really, Pepsi is trying to scrabble and hold on in the places where they do have a lead, such as Eastern Europe. Certainly, Coca-Cola is focusing its long-range view on the Pacific Rim. They just can't wait to really get into China and Indochina. They're there, but they're building infrastructure. And right now, for instance, China has a one per capita. That means everyone in China drinks one Coca-Cola per year. And if they could raise that to the level of Iceland, for instance, which drinks 396 Coca-Colas per person per year, they would be doing very well. And they say, you know, it's hot there, and boy, this could be a great market. And, of course, they're not particularly concerned about the politics of China, which is something I fault them for in the book.
Mark, did you drink a lot of Coca-Cola growing up?
No, as a matter of fact, I drank very little. My mother wouldn't let me drink Coca-Cola. She thought it was bad for me, that it would rot my teeth and my insides, and that it was full of chemicals. I found out it's not full of chemicals. It's an all-natural product, actually. But she wouldn't let me drink it, and so when I went to friends' houses, like to play football in their backyards, I would go inside and have Coca-Cola, and it was like this wonderful, forbidden, sinful, delicious drink. So it's always had that kind of flavor for me. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
Well, Mark Pendergrass, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mark Pendergrass is the author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Carole King wrote many top 40 hits of the 1960s. Then in the 70s, her album Tapestry became the best-selling album of the decade. King has a new album, The Color of Your Dreams. Coming up, we talk with King about writing songs that became hits for the Shirelles, the Drifters, Aretha Franklin, and herself. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Ordinary Time, Cycles in Faith, Marriage, and Renewal, the new spiritual autobiography by Nancy Mayers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The White House has reportedly agreed to trim its proposed energy tax and to reduce spending again. After a meeting with President Clinton, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said the president's budget will have less in the way of taxes and more in the way of spending cuts. There are no final numbers yet, but White House sources say the president might be willing to trim $20 billion from the energy tax. Mr. Clinton is negotiating with Senate leaders before his economic package goes to the Senate. The Supreme Court ruled today that religious groups must be allowed to use public schools after hours if non-religious groups are given such permission. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Lamb's Chapel Evangelical Church petitioned the Center Maurice School District on Long Island, New York, asking to use the high school auditorium after hours to show movies about family values. The school board denied Lamb's Chapel permission to show the films on the grounds that the state law allowing after-school use of school facilities excluded using the buildings for religious purposes. The Lamb's Chapel went to court, and today it won in the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that as long as the schools were available for general public use after hours and as long as a general discussion of family values would have been permitted under the rules, to exclude the showing of a film because of its religious tone is to discriminate on the basis of the content of speech. And that, said the court, is a violation of the First Amendment guarantee to free speech. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
In his first action, the new president of Guatemala today announced the replacement of the defense minister and the influential chief of staff of the presidential guard. Both men supported the deposed president, Jorge Serrano. From Guatemala City, Tom Gibb reports.
The new president, Ramiro de Leon Carpio, has started firmly by firing the top officers who supported the suspension of the Constitution 2 weeks ago. He's replaced them with other senior officers who, according to sources close to the military, opposed President Serrano's action. The new Minister of Defense, General Jorge Roberto Perusina, said this afternoon the army would obey orders. He said he believed the new president would govern Guatemala wisely. For the last 3 years, the new president was the country's human rights ombudsman, responsible for investigating and prosecuting government abuses. Many civilian leaders are hoping the ousting of President Serrano will give his successor a rare opportunity to enforce greater civilian control over the army. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in Guatemala City.
Bosnia's Muslim leaders have accepted a UN peace plan for safe havens in the republic as they appear increasingly weary from the civil war. The Bosnian government rejected the plan last week, saying the havens would become Muslim ghettos. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved lower today, down 13.01. This is NPR. German Chancellor Helmut Kohl says he didn't attend last week's funeral for the Turkish victims of a neo-Nazi attack because he didn't want to be heckled in front of TV cameras. The chancellor was widely criticized for skipping the memorial service. His comments came in a television interview today, where Kohl also argued Germans cannot generally be accused of hating foreigners. The State Department is trying to get Middle East peace talks going again. Arabs and Israelis are being asked to send delegations to Washington on June 15th. The Palestinians are due later this week for preliminary talks. Barry Schwide has more.
More than 19 months after Mideast peace talks first opened, the Arabs and Israel are still sizing each other up. In some cases, Syria and Israel especially, making tentative proposals and then pulling back, demanding more from the other side. They aren't close enough for the United States to step in with its own proposals, not even close enough for Secretary of State Warren Christopher to tack the Middle East onto the 6-day trip to Europe he begins tomorrow. But Israel is talking about peace with Syria and with Jordan and Lebanon as well. With the Palestinians, the talk is about self-rule. Not enough to satisfy the Palestinians, enough the Israelis feel to experiment with autonomy, with a more comprehensive settlement to be negotiated later. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
The World Health Organization is calling for a tenfold increase in funds to combat AIDS. At the International AIDS Conference today in Berlin, the WHO said governments and other groups should provide $2.5 billion every year. The organization's Michael Meerson says the money could help save 10 million lives by the year 2000. President Clinton says he's close to choosing a nominee for the Supreme Court to replace retiring Justice Byron White. The president said today he expects to make a decision very soon. Sources say Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt is a top contender. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Before Carole King had hit records of her own, she wrote songs that became hits for other singers. Carole King and her first husband, lyricist Jerry Goffin, were one of the most successful songwriting teams of the 60s. Their other hits included Some Kind of Wonderful, Every Breath I Take, Take Good Care of My Baby, The Locomotion, Chains, Don't Say Nothing Bad, and I'm Into Something Good. In the late 60s, King stepped out from behind the scenes and started writing music and lyrics to perform herself.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place? So fine to see your face at my door.
That's from King's 1971 album Tapestry, which remained on the charts for 6 years and broke the record for best-selling album of all time. Carole King has a new recording called Color of Your Dreams, and she's currently on a 14-city summer tour. I spoke with her in 1989 after the release of her album City Streets. When Carole King first started writing professionally, she worked with Jerry Goffin at a New York publishing company owned by Don Kirshner. Kirshner is the rock producer who hosted late-night rock concerts on TV and produced The Monkees. I wondered if it was strange to be turning out songs in a cubicle in a Manhattan office building.
Didn't matter where we did it. It was just as easy to do it there as at home, sometimes easier because, we had the kids at home. But also, in the office building, just as often, we'd have one of the kids in the room, one of said kids being, of course, Louise Goffin, who has had 3 albums out on her own.
Mm-hmm.
So she got her training really early and on the spot.
So were there like a whole corridor of offices with pianos in them and songwriters new tunes?
It's by now, it's probably fairly well known, the cubicle situation where we would be in one cubicle and Man and Wild would be in another cubicle and some other team would be in the third cubicle and we'd hear each other trying to write the same song.
Were you given assignments?
Always. Like,
what would an assignment be like?
The Drifters are just coming off a top 10 hit and we want to get the next one. Donnie Kirshner was really motivated and motivating. He was kind of a daddy figure, I guess, and we really wanted to do it for Donnie. He just kept us motivated and playing off against each other, and it was really fun. It was very competitive, but it was also fun, and the challenge of writing for new people all the time really honed our skills at writing on assignment, doing demos quickly, professionally, and cheaply. Oh, God, cheaply.
Well, the demos are the records that you'd cut for a group who was going to be recording one of your songs, and the demo would show how it's supposed to sound, you know, the melody, the lyrics,
right,
and everything. What makes a good demo?
I don't know. It just has an energy. In many cases, the sounds were really primitive. The performances were flawed. There were scratchy notes on the vocal and wrong notes on the guitar and all that stuff. And tape hiss, because we kept bouncing. At that time, the demos were monaural, one track. That's all we had. And so we just bounced back and forth. So now some of the demos eventually became records because people were telling Kirshner that the demos were so good that he said, more money to be made. Why don't I put them out? So my demo for Bobby V of It Might As Well Rain Until September became my first solo record in that decade anyway. The others before that were not worth mentioning. And Locomotion by Little Eva was, in fact, a demo for Dee Dee Sharp. And it's funny, you hear it, and you hear the drum thing in the beginning, you know, the roll, and before it you hear this enormous amount of tape hiss from the bouncing back and forth from monaural to monaural. But, you know, I always liked the fact that they were raw and real, and if there were mistakes and tape hiss, it didn't matter because it was happening.
When you were working with other groups writing songs for them in the 60s, did you usually meet them, the singers and groups that you were writing for?
Not always, but generally, yeah, because even if we weren't involved in the production, we'd often go to the sessions. We did.
What would you do if you felt that a singer or a group wasn't putting your song over right?
I don't think it ever happened.
Really?
I imagine if it did, you know, not being shy about communicating my feelings about those kind of things, I probably found a way to let somebody know or make a suggestion, but I don't know. Usually they picked up the energy from the demo, and if anything, took it, you know, way farther. One of the great moments of my life as a songwriter was the first time that I heard Aretha Franklin's version of Natural Woman, which was, in many ways, not like the demo at all. It was amazing because this was the ultimate singer in the world to me. And she was singing my song, and she had taken what I did with it and did what I never dreamed could be done with it.
And so you were thrilled. Did you for a moment feel like it was no longer your song or something?
Oh, no, okay. Not at all. Uh-huh. It was my song taken to the nth power.
How did you feel recording that song after she did it?
I felt that, you know, the idea of topping it didn't even cross my mind, but I felt that as the songwriter, I had sort of a claim on any version of it I wanted to do, and it would be okay because I wrote it. When I say I, Jerry Goffin also co-wrote that. But it wasn't even a problem in my mind. It was like two very separate things. Nobody could even approach how she sang it, so that wasn't even in my mind.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Carole King. She has a new record, and we'll hear something from it a little later. First a break. This is Fresh Air. Carole King is my guest. I think your first really big hit, your first number one hit, was a song you wrote for the Shirelles, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow. What were you keeping in mind when you wrote that song for them, one of the first girl groups?
Well, again, Jerry wrote that lyric. Jerry has written, being a man, he has written some of the best lyrics for women that exist, Natural Woman being one of them, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, another one, and one I didn't write with him, Saving All My Love for You by Whitney Houston. I think he was thinking, he did what I was talking about, he put himself in the mental persona of what it would be like to be a young girl, thinking, yeah, but will you respect me in the morning? And as far as the music went, I had in my mind there previous hit, which was Tonight's the Night, and we always kind of tried to incorporate some of the chordal feeling and the mood and the energy and just kind of write it backwards, upside down, and sideways, and the combination just worked. Also, when I was growing up, I listened to classical music a lot as well as Broadway. I had a real good background in all kinds of music, real good exposure. And so I think there's almost a classical feel to that melody and the arrangement with the cellos starting it off.
Mm-hmm. Were you expected to write in different styles for white and black performers?
Again, I don't know about expected, but one followed one's impulses, and if it was a black performer who had done something in his style that was R&B related, chances are what I would write would be related to what they had just done. But there were, you know, crossover type of records where we'd write something for a black artist and a white artist would wind up doing it, and vice versa.
I think, you know, in thinking about your body of songs from the 60s, the performer and songs that seem to fit in there the least is Steve Lawrence, songs like Go Away, Little Girl.
Well, you say fit in there the least. It just, we wrote for whoever was sort of thrown at us, and it just sort of shows that we were given a chance to demonstrate versatility, and I guess we had it because we had been exposed, Jerry and I both, to all kinds of music, you know, pop music and R&B and the baby rock and roll records that were just starting to happen in their R&B versions.
Was it a crisis for you when bands started writing their own songs? I know a lot of songwriters felt shut out in the post-Beatle years.
Yeah, I think that was a problem for us for a while. I think the bigger problem, because there were still people looking for material, but the biggest problem when Bob Dylan and the Beatles came along was not so much that they were self-contained, but that they were so good. They were so raw and so different from, we were a little more polished by that time, having had all our training and, you know, our types of exposure to Broadway and pop music, and these guys were like, you know, out there, raw. So it took us a while to figure out what it is they were doing.
And once you figured out what it is they were doing, did it change your songwriting?
Probably, but I couldn't to this day tell you how.
Mm-hmm. After you and Jerry Goffin broke up, you started writing lyrics to your own songs, and you also started performing. What was it that got you in front of the microphone on stage and in the recording studio?
I don't know. I do know that it seemed inevitable. I did a record called Now That Everything's Been Said with a group called The City, which consisted of Charlie Larkey, my bass player and also second husband, and Danny Korchmar, who is, you know, now a well-known guitar player and producer and writer in his own right. And they just kept egging me on, come on, you can do it. And we never did go on the road with The City. We had we used Jimmy Gordon as a drummer on the record, but we just never did go on the road. But then I met James Taylor and started playing as a backup musician for him. And so I'd find myself on a stage with him. And one night he said, well, why don't you, you know, do one of your songs? And I was terrified. He said, no, it'll be fine. And in the middle of his set, he introduced me to his audience as the woman that had written a lot of their favorite hits. And he was going to turn the stage over to me, and we were good friends and all. And the audience, who loved him, was sort of ready to receive me and pre-liked me. So it was like, well, okay, they're ready to like me. I guess I'll do this. And it just was real easy. I really learned from James that all you have to do is get out there and be yourself and do the song. And, you know, it's okay. It's just the same as playing it for a few friends in a living room as it is for 20,000 people.
No, I would imagine that writing songs for so many years and seeing all these great groups and singers record them, that you'd get kind of envious and sometimes wish that it were you on that stage or selling all those records with your voice on it. You never felt envious of them?
I don't know if envious is the right word. Just at a certain point, writing the songs was the main thing. To write the song, to look at this thing and say, I did that, was great. And then getting on stage for me became less of a thing about glamour and glory, which I was actually more uncomfortable with than anything. the glamour and the glory, but it was the concept of, I guess I'm the best person to present my song, or I'm the only person to present my song at this time, or whatever. It just seemed like a way of presenting the song, but to me it was always about the song.
Well, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Carole King.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Terry.
Carole King in an interview recorded in 1989. She has a new album called Color of Your Dreams. It features the song she wrote for A League of Their Own, called Now and Forever. We'll hear King's song, Tears Falling Down on Me.
Vera comes home on Sunday morning after hanging with the boys all night. Laughing and drinking with them, thinking she's one of them, and that makes everything all right. She vaguely remembers going out in the parking lot with the stone mason son, who had his way with her, then walked away when he was done. Sometimes she thinks about leaving, she tells herself someday. You know, her daddy said she'd never amount to much of anything anyway.
Carole King from her album Color of Your Dreams. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, the Congress is back in Washington, so we'll have an update on how the president's efforts to deal with the deficit are going. There is a strong possibility that the president will nominate the Interior Secretary, Bruce Babbitt, to serve on the Supreme Court. Nina Totenberg thinks it's going to happen. We'll hear from her. And from John Nielsen, who will tell us how the environmentalists feel about losing the Secretary of the Interior to the Supreme Court. We'll also have a Supreme Court decision on teaching family values in the public schools after school, and a report from the AIDS Conference in Berlin, where new funding for research is being proposed.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Spiritual autobiographies aren't too popular these days. Instead, the bestseller lists are filled with celebrity confessions and stories of self-styled survivors. But commentator Maureen Corrigan says Nancy Mayer's new autobiography, Ordinary Time, is an updated kind of spiritual autobiography. It's about Mayer's life as an oxymoron, a Catholic feminist. It's also about Mayer's struggles to come to terms with death. Reading the book made Maureen think about a movie she just saw.
At the midpoint of Ross McElwee's new documentary, Time Indefinite, which is a wonderful follow-up to his earlier film, Sherman's March, there's an extended scene that's hard to watch. McElwee's brother, who's a doctor, has removed a huge ulcerated breast tumor from a woman who claims that she never noticed it. McElwee forces us to look at a photo of that tumor for a long time as he muses about how we're all sort of like that woman, willfully denying the presence of death. After the first second, I did what I suspect a lot of other people in the theater did too. I closed my eyes until the scene ended. Nancy Mayers doesn't have the luxury of being able to close her eyes to mortality. She has multiple sclerosis. At age 49, she can't butter her bread or button her coat. Her husband George, who's 51, has been diagnosed with malignant melanoma. Mayer's autobiography, Ordinary Time, may not be your standard vacation reading, but it's not your standard movie-of-the-week treatment of fatal illness either. Listening to Mayer's talk about her approaching death is like listening to an especially blunt, thoughtful, witty, and lusty woman talking to herself as she's packing up her house to move. Mayers opens her book with George's recent confession that he had a love affair with another woman. Mayers is stunned, but she doesn't lapse into self-pity. After all, she's slept with other men. She realizes what scares her most about George's affair is her own extinction. Mayers says, throughout his sweet, stolen moments with Sandra, George lived where I was not. It's an awful, brutal insight that also lets you know ordinary time isn't Mayer's way of nominating either her or George for sainthood. Surveying the cluttered furnishings of her life, Mayers wants to understand her motivations for her two most important decisions, to become a Catholic and to become a feminist. Mayers says her feminism was an accident. She just stumbled upon the collected works of Virginia Woolf in an old cabin. I'd like her to take a little more responsibility for her own intellectual and political curiosity. Those pages of Woolf's A Room of One's Own didn't just turn by themselves. But I'm less critical of Mayer's mysterious account of her religious conversion, because I think she's right that we don't have an adequate language for discussing spirituality. If Mayers can't find the right words for God, she certainly finds them for criticizing what her church has done in God's name. She denounces Catholicism's discomfort with the female body and supports birth control and abortion rights. These days, she and George belong to a back-to-basics Catholic group that feeds the hungry, clothes the naked, and ministers to the sick. Now one of the sick herself, Mayers admits it's tougher to be on the receiving end of charity. What I admire about Nancy Mayers is that even though she has faith, she doesn't have answers. Like secular film philosopher Ross McElwee, Mayers looks steadily at death without blinking and doesn't pretend she's not scared.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Ordinary Time by Nancy Mayers. We'd like to correct a mistake in a book review last week. The author of A Walker in the City was incorrectly identified as Irving Howe. The book was written by Alfred Kazin. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, spoofing the president. We talk with political satirist and impressionist Jim Morris about working up his portrayals of Clinton, Bush, and Reagan. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.